Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm keenly aware of the fact that I'm one of the last obstacles between you and the reception hour immediately following this session. So thanks for actually getting to one more session. I'm Mark Cooper. I'm the president and founder of PKI Solutions. And we're here to talk about the top 10 most common mistakes that a lot of customers wind up either experiencing in their environment or actually are unable to detect with public key infrastructure. And specifically, we're talking about Active Directory certificate services. So to give you a little bit of background, I'm actually an ex-Microsoft person. I was with Microsoft for 10 years as a senior engineer focusing on PKI. When I started at Microsoft, about 20% of my time was focused on certificate services, and that was simply based on demand, 2003, 2004. When I left last year, 120% of my time was PKI. I had actually spent the last several years training other Microsoft engineers how to support customers such as yourselves with certificate services. While I was at Microsoft, I did a number of white papers. If you've ever read the Windows failover clustering for certificate services, that was a white paper I worked on. If you happen to have read a recently released but somewhat obscure white paper, Securing and Hardening PKI, anyone see that white paper? Yeah, it wasn't really published a whole lot. About a year and a half of effort, it was done through Microsoft Information IT and the ACE organization, released, unfortunately, without a whole lot of fanfare. And I'm currently working with Brian Komar. Anyone know Brian Komar? Probably, yeah, a few more there. Currently working with Brian on the update to the MS PKI book. Just as a little background, it will not be a MS Press book. At this point, we're looking at self-published sometime 2015. So PKI Solutions, I still focus on Active Directory certificate services, doing design consulting work, and doing assessments. So before I kind of move on a little bit, I want to get a little sense for who's in the audience today. So if you currently have a Microsoft-based PKI, raise your hand. I love this crowd. Great. How many people are thinking of doing a Microsoft PKI but don't have one yet? So a few. Perfect. You guys are the right audience for this. So what are we really talking about? One of the things I often tell customers is that just by deploying a PKI, you're not necessarily resolving all of the issues that you have. More often than not, you're going to be introducing new problems, new risks, if you're not aware of what should be done and how it should be done. More often than not, a lot of times, the UI makes it very simple to do the install. You go through the process, click, 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 you're done, and people turn away. Unfortunately, certificate services and PKI in general has lots of built-in timers. And what this often leads to is something that works really well during test, maybe user acceptance, you go into production, and then boom. At some point, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months down the road, things stop working. So without a really careful understanding of what you're configuring and how it's going to work, more often than not, you're going to run into problems. So let's talk about the list. This list actually started when I was at Microsoft. This was the foundation for a number of things that were produced at Microsoft. The information originally came from a number of sources, Microsoft Consulting Services, the organization I was with, which was Premier Field Engineering, Microsoft IT, the ACE InfoSec group. All of these groups were interacting with customers around the world with PKI. And we kept seeing the same issues over and over and over again. And the one great thing about Microsoft is there's lots of information. How do you go about doing something about it? So I took that information and started developing this best practice list. And that best practice list turned into a number of things. Anyone ever run the Certificate Services Best Practice Analyzer? All right, that's pretty typical. There's not a whole lot that that tool can do, but that information came from this list. So back when Oded Shankel was the PM on certificate services, there was a discussion of what can we do to kind of integrate this knowledge list in there. The BPA is limited to looking at the local server itself. It can't really look at an offline route, can't really look at things outside of its own sphere. So it had some limited capabilities. But it was driven by this list initially as well. The issues that are here came from just about every type of customer that's out there. From public customers, government, defense, private sectors, Microsoft's own IT. Believe me, there's nothing up here about your organization. There's nothing that is going to divulge anyone who has these things. And in truth, every single one of these was seen dozens, if not hundreds of times. So what is the benefit of looking at this stuff? Whether you use a company such as myself or a third party or Microsoft's services, the important thing with certificate services is since it's the foundation to so many things in your environment, you really need to know how it's configured and how it's working properly. As I mentioned, a lot of things inside of certificate services will kind of lie in wait. It's not there to get you. It just has a lot of built-in timers, has a lot of built-in expirations, a lot of validity periods. And without a thorough understanding of what you've implemented and how you've implemented it, you're more often than not going to run into some of these problems. So I'm hoping that you'll get from today's session is to be able to identify at least one thing that you have in your environment that needs to be fixed. Hopefully two, no more than that. If you've got more than that, come talk to me. But I really wanted this session to be something that you can actually have some actionable things and go back and look at. So this isn't kind of a high-level theoretical stuff. This isn't architectural design. These are things I want you to be able to go back and look at your own environment, go through the list and go, we're okay there, we're okay there. Oh, we got this one. How do we fix it? So let's talk about issue number one, CRLs. Let's see a show of hands. Anyone feel completely comfortable with how you manage CRLs today? All right. So CRLs, certificate revocation lists. The most ironic thing for me when it comes to certificate services is how so much depends on revocation lists. And that's really the truth about PKI. As you're probably aware, a certificate authority really has little to no role in the moment-to-moment verification of the certificate. Once a certificate's been issued out, it's kind of out of the picture. Its job, however, is to make sure that certain pieces of information are available in the environment. One of those is the certificate revocation list. And there's a number of things you need to keep in mind when you're dealing with this. One is the concept of intervals. How often is the revocation list going to be published? Just like a certificate, it's got a defined lifetime. If that revocation list can't be accessed, can't be found, or is expired, it might as well not exist. According to the RFC, if you can't get verification or revocation, assume the certificate is invalid. So it essentially means that if you allow your CRL to become expired or it's not accessible, your certificates will stop working. The other concept is the fact that most often certificates are being used for identification. So if we're talking about things like smart cards, VPN access, wireless access, it's one part of the triad. A certificate being presented is really just the identification of a logon, the same as a username and password. There's still the authentication portion that happens behind the scenes. So in the case of wireless, the machine may present a certificate, it gets validated, the Active Directory behind the scenes is the part that's actually doing the authentication. So keep those in mind when we talk about revocation lists. One of the things that we also have to factor in the fact is the fact that Windows will cache any revocation list it sees. So if you have a revocation list that's good for 7 days, it's published Monday at noon, it's valid until noon the following week. If a client looks at that revocation list on Tuesday, it's not going to go back until next Monday. So what happens if you revoke something Wednesday? That client's not going to know about that. So we've got a few things that we have to factor into there. Now, there are some things that you can do to manipulate this. Up until Windows 2000, there really was no supported way to clear out that cache. If you're in a lab environment or you're really kind of needing to remediate certain things, you can use the certutil command to refresh that chain. So certutil setreg and the chain resync, you're essentially saying everything that you have cached, I want you to mark as expired right now. That is supported by Microsoft. It does work. It doesn't necessarily mean that all your higher level applications are going to be aware of the fact that a cache is changed underneath. So where this can come into play, let's say you've got a RADIUS server, you've had a number of certificates that have been compromised, or maybe just one laptop that's been lost. you need to tell that radius server not to allow that workstation on. You can revoke the certificate, tell the radius server to clear its cache, and it'll pick up a new revocation list. There is a less effective one where you're actually just deleting out the URL cache, but it's not as comprehensive as deleting out all the cache information. That one has been around for quite some, the URL cache delete. It still technically works, but it's not as handy. So why are we talking about CRL? What can you do about improving your CRLs? Well, one is this concept of the next update. Inside of the revocation list, and we've got a copy up on your screen right now, is this flag called next update. We also have the next CRL publish. But the next update allows us to manipulate how clients see a revocation list and when they think it's going to expire. And this is actually set on the CA itself. And you're often hear it referred to as an overlap, a CRL overlap and a delta overlap. And they each have their own respective registry value to do this. So what does the overlap allow us to do? Well, if we come over and we take a look at this slide here, you can see that we've got an effective date. And I apologize, the screen cuts it off a little bit. But we've got an effective date of September 12th at 1:42 p.m. So that's when the revocation list was published. The CA, at whatever interval it had, created this revocation list at that point in time. If you ever notice when you look at this, the revocation list and pretty much everything a CA does is backdated 10 minutes. The reason for that is for time skew. So if we have a CA that creates a revocation list, and you have a KDC allowance of 10 minutes, the revocation list goes out there and you've got a client that's a few minutes behind or a few minutes ahead, we don't want to see a revocation list and assume it's invalid. So the CA backdates at 10 minutes. With the overlap defined, what we're going to do is we're going to come in here and define when are we going to publish our next CRL. So this tells the client, I want you to come back September 19th, so a week from now, at 1:42, and look for a new revocation list. So that sounds pretty much like the default behavior so far. So the client will cache that for a week. It comes back a week later. If it does not find it, the next value comes into play. So the overlap in this case tells it you can continue to use this revocation list until the 20th at 1:42. So we've gained a day. Doesn't seem like that big of a deal. But here's the thing about it. Without using an overlap, you have no minimum response time to a revocation failure. Just because a revocation list is valid for 7 days, the CA could fail 5 minutes before it's due, which means you've got 5 minutes to fix the problem or everything stops working. It could be 5 minutes after it publishes the revocation list. It's luck of the draw. But with the overlap, in this case, you've got a guaranteed 24 hours to fix the problem. So no matter where it happens in that cycle, the client will always have at least 24 hours. This doesn't address the issue of a client not having a copy of the revocation list. We're simply talking about what happens if our CA is unavailable. The overlap that we're talking about, the 24 hours, it cannot be longer than the base interval. So if our base interval is 7 days, we can't have an overlap of 14 days. We can go up to another 7 days. So when we're talking about delta CRL, if you've got deltas that are coming out, let's say, every 12 hours, your maximum overlap is going to be another 12 hours. But you have at least a minimum defined recovery period. And that's something that does not exist without an overlap. You can put this into play at any time. Doesn't mean reissuing client certificates. Doesn't mean renewing your CA certificates. You can set this registry value, publish a new revocation list, and the value will be there at the next CRL publish. One thing to keep in mind is third-party support. All Windows platforms will support this. If you've got Macintosh, iOS, Linux, and they're validating certificates, I can't tell you whether they will understand that concept. But that's not a Microsoft concept. That is an RFC-driven concept. So, number one, CRL management. So, what are the other things that you can do around CRLs? One of them is, how are you actually distributing your revocation information? It used to be until a few years ago, we had Active Directory, HTTP, and file UNC locations. File UNC locations disappeared in 2008. You can still technically do them for older clients, but it really doesn't make much sense anymore. Active Directory, enabled by default. You turn on an online CA, it starts putting everything up in Active Directory. What's the benefit of that? One, it works out of the box, and two, it's fault tolerant. You've got two or more DCs, that means every location in your environment has the revocation information. Clients are site aware, they already have a secure channel to a domain controller. It's already taken care of for you right out of the box. For many environments, that's not going to work as well. If you've got an environment where you're using Delta CRLs and you're publishing every hour, but your Active Directory convergence is 3 hours, it's not going to work. It's there as a convenience. Many environments choose not to use Active Directory. You can use HTTP. You can do the same exact delivery of revocation information with HTTP. But that means it's up to you to set up a highly available, resilient website delivery of revocation information. The good thing is there's nothing sensitive in that file. There's no computer names, there's no server names, there's no user names. It's the serial numbers. So many organizations put that on their public-facing website. You're already paying for something highly available. They want it internal and external. You just have to get it up there. So why choose Active Directory or HTTP if they both essentially do the same thing? A lot of times it's driven by accessibility. What kind of clients are you using? If you're mostly a university where you have a lot of Unix systems, a lot of unmanaged Active Directory, or kind of oxymoron, unmanaged Windows machines, and it's not an environment where they're all getting the Active Directory, HTTP is probably your better option. If you're a Windows shop, you don't have lots of highly available websites, there's nothing wrong with Active Directory. So either one of them will work for you. One of the things that comes up a lot of times is this concept of CRL availability or CA availability. And a lot of times customers will ask, I want a highly available CA. I want a fault-tolerant CA. My number one question is, what do you want availability for? Can you set up a geodispersed cluster, have a SAN underneath, have replication going back and forth? Sure, I wrote the white paper on, not a problem. But why? Most environments are not concerned with the moment-to-moment issuance of certificates. They want things to keep working. The CA goes down, I don't want people to be blocked from getting on a wireless network. I don't want them to be blocked from using a smart card. They want them to keep working. That means revocation information needs to be available, not the CA. So if you can devise a way of using overlap so that your CRLs are available if the CA is unavailable to issue them, and the distribution is fault tolerant, you've achieved that goal. You don't have to go out and spend lots of money on a cluster. That's an important distinction to make when you're thinking about availability of your certificate infrastructure. Now the other one. How many people use Delta CRLs? Show of hands. Okay, and look, about 7 or 8. That's where I would like to see things. We'll talk a little bit more about Delta CRLs later on. For most environments, and this is a generalization, I hate generalizations, but I have to make them sometimes, Delta CRLs are generally unnecessary for most environments. Delta CRLs came about for very large organizations in the US, the defense industry, for instance, dealing with tens or hundreds of megabytes of information in a revocation list. Very inefficient to distribute that and cache that to every client. Deltas were a way of having an incremental set of information since the last baseline CRL. For most environments, you'll never get there. When I was at Microsoft for 10 years, I never saw a single CRL file bigger than about 5 or 6 meg. And that was an environment that had about 6 million issued certificates in it. Is there anything wrong with Deltas? No. Is there anything wrong if you leave it enabled? No. But don't sweat if you have a lot of complications from Delta CRLs, you choose not to do Delta CRLs, it's okay. The odds are you're not gonna need them. All right, so now we talked about CRLs, let's talk about the other part of revocation, OCSP, Online Certificate Status Protocol. It was designed to address those limitations in CRLs. So you've got an environment with lots of revocation information. What can you do to make that process more efficient. And there are some common misperceptions around what OCSP is and how to use it. One, as I mentioned, it was designed to overcome the inefficiencies of moving large revocation lists around. Because frankly, the way revocation list processing works, if your environment has one of these 100 megabit files, you could literally have to go through the process of a client needing to validate one certificate, having to go down a 100 megabyte revocation list, looking through it to find one serial number. That's a huge impact to your bandwidth and to the client. Not the most efficient way of doing it. OCSP changes that model to a much more transaction-oriented model, much like you would do in a SQL query. What OCSP does is the client says, OCSP server, please tell me if serial number 12345 has been revoked. That's all that's sent on the network. The OCSP responder has a copy of that large revocation list in some centralized location and responds back with a signed request saying, yes, it's revoked, or no, it's not revoked. Much more efficient. You can blow your CRLs up to 500 meg. It's not going to affect the client. All that happens up on the OCSP responder. There are some other things to keep in mind with that, though. It is still dependent on your revocation list. Microsoft Active Directory Certificate Services does not actually interact with the CA. It's looking at a revocation list that was published. Now, that could be an Active Directory location, it could be your HTTP location, or it could actually be physically located locally on the OCSP server. How you choose to implement that is up to you. The other thing is, it is still dependent on your interval that was defined in the revocation list. OCSP does not overcome the timeliness of information. So if you've got a CRL that's good for 7 days, your OCSP response is going to be good for 7 days. It doesn't make things expire that much quicker. You can tell the OCSP server to look for an updated CRL much more often. But as far as the client is concerned, it's going to get a very small response, but it's going to cache it for the same amount of time. What that means is there is no real-time information that's coming. Now, there was an effort by the CA browser forum, the CAB forum, to actually request a change to how Microsoft OCSP responder was working. One of the concerns was a potential vulnerability in that a client could ask, is serial number 12345 revoked? Since the OCSP server does not interact with the CA, it simply looks at a revocation list, comes back and says, no, it's not revoked, or it is revoked. What if that serial number was never even issued by the CA? It's called a deterministic result. Honestly, though, the same thing exists inside of a CRL file. So even without OCSP, if you download a revocation list and you're looking at a particular serial number, it's either there or it's not there. The absence of that serial number doesn't tell you that it was actually issued as a valid certificate. It simply tells you the CA has not revoked that certificate. But with OCSP, there is a hotfix that came out relatively recently that adds a deterministic value into that response. So now the responder will actually say, yes, it's been revoked, no, it has not been revoked, or I don't know about this. So if it says yes is a valid certificate, that means the CA has given information to the OCSP responder to say, this certificate was issued, and no, it has not been revoked. So now I have three states. So that is available via a hotfix. With the OCSP, the most common thing, as I mentioned, is making sure you're using it the right way, but also in a secure way. So with OCSP, there are a few things to kind of keep in mind. One is the fact that the OCSP is actually signing each and every request that comes in with a CA certificate, or excuse me, not a CA certificate, with a signing certificate. That means each CA that your OCSP server is responding on behalf of, it needs to have issued an OCSP responder certificate to the OCSP server. So if you've got three CAs and they're all configured with an OCSP extension, that means your responder needs three certificates, one from each CA. Because when a client comes and requests that revocation information, when it gets signed, it needs to come from a trusted source. It needs to be from that CA itself. That request obviously comes from the CA, or the OCSP certificate comes from the CA. And because of that, when the CA creates an OCSP responder certificate, it's going to use its current key pair. So whatever public and private key pair is currently configured on the CA, that's the public key that gets signed onto the OCSP responder certificate. So what happens if you renew your CA? Well, now you've got an old key pair, and you've got a new key pair. Those are distinct key pairs, and there are going to be client certificates that are issued off of each one of those. You need the OCSP server to be able to respond to requests from certificates generated with the old pair, as well as the new pair. Out of the box, OCSP does not handle this scenario. There's a registry change that you have to do this. But out of the box, right now, if you have OCSP in your environment and you have not enabled the setting, you will have a problem the moment that you renew your CA certificate. So what does this look like? So here's our base timeline for our OCSP. We have a CA key. Doesn't matter really the length. Let's just say it's 5 years. So we created our key, and we have an expiration that's up there. We issue an OCSP certificate signed by that CA public key. We install our OCSP responder. Everything seems to be working great. We then issue a client certificate. And you'll notice that everything is in green because it's coming from that same key pair. So we issue a client certificate to some client that's out on our network. We issue another client certificate to client two. We can even get another OCSP certificate because they're short-lived. They don't live for a very long time, 7 days, 14 days, whatever is a reasonable time in your environment. And at some point, we wind up renewing our CA. And you'll notice that there's a bit of an overlap here. And that's because the old CA key was valid. The new CA key comes into play. So now we get a new certificate. Because the OCSP server, it's a week or two later, it needs a new certificate. It's now signed by the new key pair, our orange key pair. So now when something comes in and says, can you tell me about client one? It's not going to work. That response back to that machine is going to be signed with a new key pair, which is not the same key pair that was used originally to issue client one. So how do we fix this? So the scenario looks the same, except this time we've set this registry value. Use define CA cert in request. What this does is you define this on your CA, and what happens is when the OCSP server makes its request to renew a certificate, it actually says what the original CA key pair was that was used to sign it. So the OCSP server is specifying this. So we have our original key pair. We do our OCSP cert, our client certs. We get another OCSP cert. There's our key renewal. There's our OCSP cert signed by the old key. And we also get a new key. Because of the fact that the CA has the old keys and has certificates that are valid off of that, but now it has a new functional key for everything issued going forward, the OCSP server is now going to have two certificates from the same CA. So it can sign behalf of the old key pair and the new key pair. So now when something comes in and says, is the CA key one valid? That works. We can also get another OCSP client certificate. So that setting, one more time, use define CA cert in request. If you have OCSP in your environment and you haven't set this, this will become an issue for you. This is definitely one of those things that tends to lie in wait because everything's working great. I'm sorry, what was the question? No, you set this on your CA itself. So already today, your OCSP server is sending this information to your CA, but the default setting on the CA does not allow that to come in. So that's the only place you have to do it. Anytime you do a cert util set reg, you have to restart certificate services because that's when those settings are read. So easy to do. So number four, ADCS hotfixes. Now, this is an interesting one, only because this was a passion of mine for a long time when I was at Microsoft. Microsoft has Windows updates, Microsoft has hot fixes. If they're not clear in your mind, they should be. Updates come via Windows Update, WSUS, SCCM, whatever you choose to do patch update inside your environment. Hot fixes, on the other hand, are not automatically distributed. Sometimes you have to specifically request them. Sometimes you can go onto the support website and you can retrieve them yourself. But these are not put automatically out into the channel. They don't have the same regression testing. They are targeted hot fixes for specific problems. Inside of certificate services, there have been known issues and problems over the years. However, there is no comprehensive consolidated place you can go to and find out all the hot fixes as they relate to certificate services. Something I identified a long time ago, I talked to the product team for a long time, just wasn't there. There is the ability to use these a little differently. You don't specifically have to wait until you have the problem to fix it. If you're using the technology and you know that there's a hot fix as it relates to it, test it and put it into play. You don't have to wait till you get a database corruption. You don't have to wait until something breaks. If you know it pertains to something you're doing, test it and deploy it. So I actually created this list. One of the benefits of no longer being at Microsoft is if I want to put information up there, I can put information up there. So on my website, pkisolutions.com, is the ADCS-hotfixes. This is something I keep updated on a regular basis. Since it went up earlier this year, I've made, I think it's about 10 changes so far. There's currently 77 hotfixes across all the releases of Windows so far. So I have two classifications. One are hotfixes themselves, and the other ones are known issues. So known issues may be things that don't necessarily have a software fix, but are unique as they go into it. So for instance, with 2012, there was a change to the session zero isolation that made hardware security modules not work out of the box if you're using certain types of key protection. Known issue, easy to fix if you know where to go. I also thought it was quite interesting. 2008 R2 had the most number of hot fixes that came out. That kind of surprised me a little bit. I really thought it was going to be 2003. Speaking of 2003, how many people still have a 2003 Windows CA? A few, okay. July 2015, right? Okay, guys? 8 months? My schedule's busy July of next year, so. No, I was actually in Marrakesh 2 weeks ago doing a presentation just on Server 2003, the end of life cycle support and CAs. Just as a side note, please, they need to get updated. All right, so hot fixes. Available on my website anytime that you want. It will be updated regularly. I also have client-related issues. Now, I made a distinction in that I didn't want to list every potential certificate-related client update. Frankly, there's a lot. So I focus on those things that are relating to Active Directory certificate services. Auto-enrollment-related issues, template issues, things that would relate to you from a client perspective if you're running a Microsoft ADCS PKI. So number five, network device enrollment service. Anyone dealing with BYOD, Internet of Things, iPads, iOS, Linux, yeah. This has been an interesting phenomenon for me. I spent years on the corporate IT side, and at the time, the firewall was, no, you're not bringing any of those toys in. You're not using your home computer. No. If it's not a corporate asset, not something that we've configured, set up antivirus, you're not bringing it in. I think the world's changed a little bit on us. So network device enrollment service. This is Microsoft's implementation of SEP, the Simple Certificate Enrollment Protocol. It's been leveraged by a number of products. Microsoft has a number of solutions that are based off of it. It's really designed for machines or devices that aren't integrated into your Active Directory authentication process. It's a two-step disjointed enrollment. You as a particular account go to a website, you get a one-time use, usually, one-time use password, you take that to whatever your device is, you plug that in, and that device can go enroll with whatever permissions you would have. There are no controls over what types of certificate it can get, as long as your account that you got the password with has permissions, you can get that. There's nothing that says that password is assigned to one particular machine, none of that. It's simply, here's a password that identifies who you are, plug in your machine. It was originally designed for switches and routers, very basic entry-level authentication devices that don't have the capability of doing things like Kerberos or NTLM. It really was a simple enrollment protocol. It's been around for quite some time from the Microsoft side, the resource kit. Anybody missed resource kits? No one? Am I the only one? Resource kits were great. Anyone know the story of what happened to resource kits? So the product teams were essentially told, if it's not good enough to own and maintain, get rid of it. So a lot of those kind of funky tools that were valuable but still had like the really old 1980s icons got tossed. There was some pretty cool stuff in there. One of them, thankfully, that was salvaged was the network device enrollment servicer back then. It was just MSSEP, Microsoft SEP. Luckily, it got integrated in the product with Server 2008. So it's been in the product since then and officially supported. But there were customers that were running it prior to 2008. So we got the BYOD. There are third-party products like MobileIron, AirWatch. They all have solutions that can actually integrate with your Microsoft CA to do certificate enrollment. Some of them historically have leveraged NDIS. Thankfully, a lot of them are coming around now using the RPC DCOM interface, so they're actually a rich enrollment experience. But there are a couple of things that are causing problems. This concept of certificate enrollment with a one-time use disjointed was never really intended for how it's being used today. In order to do a lot of these BYOD things, the servers need to be placed accessible to the internet, so DMZ, open firewall ports. There's a whole lot less control around what they were originally designed to do. So a couple of new things. I was hoping that there would be a URL, but there is a change. So I actually just got done, about 2 months ago, writing a white paper for Microsoft on some new security processes on hardening and securing NDIS. Hopefully it'll be out soon. It was really driven by the new Intune and the new policy module, which I'll talk about here shortly. So Microsoft, seeing what a lot of third parties were doing, wanted to improve the security of NDIS and offer a BYOD solution that extended beyond the Windows desktop. But that meant putting this out in an accessible location. I don't have a URL to tell you to go to. If you watch the support forums, you watch my website, there'll be some information that'll come out. But we'll most likely be doing a revision to this paper before it does come out. So what does that look like? A couple of things. One is with the NDIS, and these are things that you could do today, even if you're not going to use the new Intune and the policy modules, a couple of things you can be aware of. One is the fact that NDIS is a completely URI-driven tool because it's website, one-time passwords, and you can configure long-term passwords if you want. You can actually control access to this simply by using firewall rules. So if you define who's getting to the admin page, who's doing the enrollment page, these are things that you could do today with your firewall. You don't have to worry about the Intune or the policy module. Also make sure SSL is there. So NDIS fully supports SSL, just doesn't do it out of the box. So set yourself up in SSL, whether it's going to be a public cert or an internal cert, depending on what types of clients are coming in. Some additional improvements there. The other one that was tested for this white paper is the fact that the NDIS was one of the last roles that had not been in a supported state of using a hardware security module. The NDIS server has a requester certificate that, while not quite as powerful as a CA, has a lot of utilization and value behind it. The NDIS server is actually signing every request that comes in and is what is actually ACLed on your CA to get the certificates. That means if there's a key compromise on your NDIS server, that means that you could have a lot of fraudulent certificate issuance. The Heartbleed exploit is actually a good example of this. While it was not a Microsoft vulnerability, honestly, there's nothing that says it couldn't in the future. The biggest thing about that vulnerability is it allowed access to the private memory. Anytime you're dealing with signing keys that are stored in software, accessed inside of memory, vulnerabilities like that are always going to be a risk. Just something to be aware of. So what can you do about that? If you're going to have a machine that's going to be sitting exposed to the internet while facilitating things like BYOD, how can you protect that? You can actually use a hardware security module with NDIS to protect those keys. Those keys are no longer kept in memory. They're kept on a third-party device. Anytime that signing operation happens, it's happening in that third-party box. There are no keys in memory to become compromised. So this is actually something that, while never unsupported, just was never explicitly stated before. So working with the product team, when this white paper comes out, there'll be an official configuration of how to use a hardware security module and NDIS to actually protect those signing keys. So the new policy module. I'm not going to spend much time on this because I'm sure there are other sessions on this, but I did want to talk about what the new capabilities are. The problem with NDIS previously, as I mentioned, is the fact that once the administrator comes in and authenticates, they get a one-time password, and whatever they're ACL to, that's what the request will be allowed to enroll for. There's nothing that the administrator can do to say, I'm getting this one-time password for a particular user for a particular type of certificate. What the policy module does is now when you have a management device, and the policy module does not exist by default. This is something that you install. So the only one to date so far is the Microsoft Intune, but the underlying framework and the API is there. So you could write your own policy module, or other third parties may come out with this. So in this particular example, we've got an MDM solution, and it's going to call a standard NDIS interface. In that call, instead of getting just a simple one-time password, it's passing information. It's saying, here's the particular user or device that I'm going to be sending this information to. It's going to be for a particular type of certificate, and that gets associated together. The NDIS has no way of processing that. So in our flowchart number two, the NDIS actually passes all that over to the policy module. The policy module then generates the one-time password, but it also makes a connection that says this time, this one-time password is good for this particular user or device for this particular type of certificate. It sends that information back to the MDM solution. The MDM solution sends that to whatever client it's managing. And when the client comes in to do an enrollment, the same type of password. It comes back with that password. The NDIS server goes, I'm configured to use a policy module, passes it through. The policy module validates that password, says, oh, okay, you're this particular user, you're this particular certificate, there you go. So we're using the same enrollment process, the same certificate process, but now we're putting some rules around this. So if you've got a unique scenario that you need to do SEP-based enrollment, you can do that in your environment by writing your own policy module. You don't have to wait for a third party to do this. So that's available with 2012 R2. So certificate validity periods. This is another area that has the potential for generalization. So I like to kind of talk a little bit about abstracts and talk about the effect of doing certain things. Like anything in crypto, there's never an easy answer. It's why people like me have a business. There is no single answer I can give everyone in this room to tell you how long your key should be. But there is some general rules I use when planning these things. One of them is I start from the bottom. If you're not already aware, the fact that a CA cannot issue a certificate that lives beyond its own lifetime. So if you've got a CA good for 5 years, it can't issue something for 6 years. The closer you get to that 5-year expiration period, the shorter things are that it issues. So if you're 2.5 years into that period, everything it's issuing, if it's longer than 2.5 years by design, will actually get shortened. So everything pretty much expires on the same day. So how can you design around that? Well, one, start with the bottom. Figure out what your client needs are, your users, your devices, those end entity certificates are. Figure out what the longest one is going to be. Once you have an idea of what that is, just start multiplying by 2 all the way up. Gross generalization, but gives you a framework to work with. And I'll talk about why the twice lifetime. So along with that, you need to figure out the usefulness or the validity period usefulness to you, that's often tied to the crypto. If you're using 1024 RSA, your validity period is essentially non-existent, but is going to be much shorter than an ECC cert. ECC being more complex, has a longer useful crypto lifetime to you, you can have a longer validity period. If you're using much shorter keys, much simpler crypto, you're going to need to have keys that expire very quickly. So for instance, if you're doing something with NAP, even though it's going away, it's a good concept I like to use in examples. With NAP, you're issuing a health certificate every couple of hours to a device. Honestly, number one, no one's going to really attempt to compromise those keys. But two, even if they did, they're so short-lived that by the time they're potentially compromised, they've expired. So you don't really need super strong crypto for those types of keys. So if we look at a generalization of what a lot of environments will do, from a generalization, and I know you all love to take screenshots out of books. I can't tell you how many times I've seen people copy Brian Komar's three-tier PKI and put it into their environment. So use it as a baseline, a discussion point. So a lot of environments like to do something like a 10-year root CA, a 5-year enterprise CA, maybe 2 years for device certificates. Well, what happens with that? So here's our scenario. We've got some devices that are out there that are getting 2 years. Things work great the first couple of years. Then we're 2 years in, and we issue some more certs. And they're still good for 2 years. Well, your CA is still good for another year. People like to wait to the last minute to do anything, so the CA is not renewed. What's going to happen? Now our device certs are getting truncated to 1 year because the CA expires in 1 more year from that point. It starts truncating. The closer you get to the expiration, the shorter and shorter things are. Luckily, there's actually a little bit of logic in the Windows client. If you ever look at a certificate template, there's a renewal period set on the template. It actually tells the client when should it attempt to start renewing a certificate prior to the expiration, and by default, it's 6 weeks. If you actually get to only 6 weeks left where something could be issued, it actually won't request a certificate anymore because it knows as soon as it requests it, it's going to have to start renewing it. So there's some built-in logic to prevent that. So how can you keep your device certs from getting truncated? One is this concept of half-life renewals. Many organizations only perform new key renewals. But Microsoft Certificate Services really has two types. There's the same key and there's a new key. And you can actually leverage this to make your environment a little simpler. With the same key, you're essentially taking the same public-private key pair that you have on your CA, which means your OCSP, all your device certs are all tied to that key. You can renew that key and keep the same key pair. You're extending the validity period of that. That means OCSP and all those things keep working. When you renew with a new key, you're generating a new public and private key pair, and everything is going to chain up to that new key pair. So remember that OCSP example I showed where you had multiple key pairs, multiple OCSPs? So there's something we can do about that. So here's our same scenario, 10-year root, 5-year enterprise CA, 2-year device cert. Well, 2.5 years into our CA, our cryptographic key is still valuable to us. We define 5 years. So our enterprise CA was good for 5 years. Whatever cryptographic solution I chose, I was comfortable with 5 years of usefulness out of that key pair. But I'm trying to negate the clients being truncated. So if 2.5 years into that, I perform a renewal with the same key, because it's still cryptographically valuable to me. I just need a little extra time to continue working. By doing a renewal with the same key, when I start issuing my client certs, at the 5-year period, and this is where it gets a little trickier, you have to be aware of this, at the end of my original 5-year period, because remember, if we set this up in the year 2000, our CA was good till 2005, halfway through I renewed again, that means my CA is technically good till 2007, but cryptographically to me, it ended after 5 years. So at the end of the 5-year period, I need to renew again. But this time I'm going to renew with a new key, because I've used up those 5 years off of that key. But even with that, my clients are never affected, and this pattern would just go on and on and on and on. So one of the values of doing twice the lifetime working your way up the chain is if you do these same key renewals at the midpoint, you'll never have anything truncated below. But what that means is nothing is going to remind you that you've reached the end of the cryptographic usefulness of a key pair. So it's a little more of an advanced concept, but something you can leverage to keep your clients from getting truncated. Also makes it simpler than generating new key pairs all the time. So key protection. Anyone here dealing with data protection in your environment of any kind? Encryption, signing, validation, anything. All right. How about payments? Anyone doing like payment processing, that kind of stuff? Yeah, I didn't think so. One of the interesting things that I think most organizations are facing right now is issues around data theft, data loss. It's interesting because many years ago, the conversations I would have with customers around protecting CAs, protecting PKI, protecting keys, it was always a theoretical discussion. Do you have some intellectual property for some widget that you manufacture that you're concerned about espionage? No. Never were concerned, never was a realistic threat, never wanted to do anything about it. Now the conversation is, do you have any kind of corporate data? Okay, when is it going to get compromised? It's a very different world that's out there. Any information that's out there, inevitably somebody's gonna wanna get to. So the conversation now is, how do we protect it rather than fixing it after it's lost? So with CAs, whether it's the Certificate Authority, the OCSP, the ENDIS, these are all signing keys that have a lot of power in your environment. A good example I often use with customers is when we start talking about smart cards. And here's a good example, and I suspect I know the answer here. How many organizations have a process that when a user leaves the organization, HR or someone else gets notified, and eventually IT is told this person's leaving and their account gets disabled after they're gone? How many people have a process like that? That's pretty well established for most environments. HR knows that they're leaving, disable the account. Why? Now, couldn't you just ask the employee, hey, please don't come into our network after you've left? No, you don't trust them anymore, right? Same thing with the CA keys. When you start dealing with things like smart cards, it's a very different paradigm. Imagine that scenario, employee leaves the organization, and let's say somebody had an inkling that maybe they were going to be attempting to get back into the network. Well, you've disabled their account. If they're IT, you could go, you know what, they probably know some of the service accounts. Let's change all the service account passwords. If you're really paranoid, or it was a really bad day when they left, you could tell everyone in your organization, change your passwords. If you know all the passwords are changed, they're not going to get back in, unless they hack or something else. But they're not going to be able to use any information that they gathered before. If, however, they were able to get a hold of their CA key, and that same person left the organization, and you told everybody to change your password, doesn't mean a thing. With that CA key, they can stand up a copy of your CA, issue a smart card as anyone in the organization, their boss, the CEO, the CTIO, doesn't matter. Not only that, you won't even know it happened. Even if you're sitting there looking at the firewall rules, you'll simply say, Joe Smith just authenticated. All right, you have two options. Know that Joe Smith is sitting next to you and he didn't actually put the smart card in. Or two, and this is the fun part, you suspect it's going on, so you go to all your authentication points and you turn up your logging, you look for serial numbers, you take the serial numbers, you go to your CA and you look to see if that serial number matches the subject name of what came in. That doesn't exist out of the box. All that's going to do is tell you, wait, there's some illegitimate smart cards going on. So it's much easier to protect against that scenario than figure out it's happening and remediate against it. So we've got CAs that are signing things like smart cards, signing things like code signing, document signing. These are all things that are pretty important to many environments. What can you do to protect it? Well, one, I mentioned a little bit this concept of hardware security modules. So companies like SafeNet, Tumalto, I guess now, and Talos, kind of the leading guys out there doing hardware security modules where those keys are kept outside of the operating system. So things like Heartbleed vulnerabilities, don't expose your keys to unnecessary people. The other thing that these do is because the fact that the keys are not kept stored in the software, they're either accessed in the hardware security module or they're stored there depending on the implementation. That means you can have your backups processed normally. You don't have to worry about, okay, I backed up my CA, I've got my CA tape sitting here, how do I securely get that to a facility knowing who's backing
up this tape and holding onto it. There's many organizations I've worked with where they've done great physical security with their CAs. They've got locks on cabinets and cameras and auditors and security logs. And then their backup tape's sitting right at the receptionist desk waiting for Iron Mountain to pick up. All right, so your keys are sitting there. What is that going to do for you? So HSMs can actually be used across the entire signing sphere now, the CA, the OCSP, and the NDIS server. There are some other ways of doing this. Many of them I don't like. So TPM. How many people know that you can store your CA key in a TPM, a trusted platform module? Okay. I'm hoping that no one raises their hand for this. How many people have actually done that in production? Oh, thank you. So TPM, so great things for things like BitLocker. You've got a client, they're going to encrypt their disk. You put in the BitLocker. If there's a problem, you've got a recovery key. A CA is not so fortunate. The whole purpose of storing your CA key in a TPM is protected against loss. Well, that means if your TPM becomes corrupted, how do you recover? You can't. You can't back up a TPM. So if your CA signing key is in the TPM chip, and the chip goes bad, and the machine goes bad, you have to reinstall the operating system or reinitialize the TPM, your environment's gone. Without the signing key, your CA is no good. So while it's technically possible, you can even do it with a smart card. Smart card's got kind of the same problem. You can't back up a smart card. If smart card's lost, if it's destroyed, gets cut up, if it's stolen, it's got limitations. But the keys, what I often tell customers is this concept of a moment alone can never be unknown. From the time that that CA key is created until it expires, it should always be protected and should always be requiring a multi-person access that I'll talk about as well. So architecture. So painting some broad strokes here. Another problem that comes up for a lot of environments is the wrong architecture. I can't tell you how many times I've gone in and I've looked at a PKI environment and I go, oh, this is a Brian Komar number two special. And it's nothing against the architecture. It's nothing against the book. It's nothing against Brian. It's just that human nature is often, I don't know how to do this. I'll go look at a white paper or a book and I'll do what the book says. It doesn't necessarily scale it right for your environment. So what often comes up a lot? More often than not, an environment has a single tier, an enterprise root CA, or it's got three tiers. And the vast majority of the time, it's the wrong architecture. Many years ago, we would start with a three tier as the starting point. Do you want three tier? If not, where do we go from there? Truthfully, it is the most flexible. It can be the most secure. It can be configured more diverse than anything else. But do you need that? That's the question that's very difficult to generalize. So if I have to generalize, what are some of the things? The odds are, if you have a policy or an intermediate CA, so we're talking about three-tier, root CA, policy CA, enterprise CA. Okay, so let's just do a quick poll. How many people have a policy slash intermediate CA in their environment? Raise your hand, and just leave them raised for a moment. Okay, now, how many of those same people have a CA policy INF file on that same server? Okay, so most of the hands stayed up. If your hand went down, the odds are you're not using that machine the right way. The book shows root CA, policy CA, subordinate CA, and a lot of customers will do that. But then the policy CA isn't doing anything. It's there because the book showed three tiers. So from a generalization standpoint, if there's not a CA policy high enough, the odds are that CA is not actually doing anything except sucking up bandwidth or a VM or a client license. There are things that policy CA can do for you. Its primary job is to restrict what a subordinate CA does. So if you don't trust your administrators or you're sticking this thing out on the cloud and you want to restrict what it can issue, you use a policy CA when it signs the subordinate CA to restrict what can actually do. Now the other one, single tier. How many people have a single enterprise root CA? So just a single CA, nothing above, nothing below. So a smaller percentage. Those are great. There's nothing wrong with those at all. A lot of organizations oftentimes will start with, I want some internal SSL certs. That's a great place to start with an enterprise root. You don't have to have an offline environment. When is a single CA not the best idea? When you start dealing with things that are high assurance. You start dealing with things that are smart card oriented, code signing, encryption, secure email, things that you're really trying to protect information, that becomes much, much more difficult with a single tier CA. That's a generalization. That's not saying that those of you that have that are doing the wrong thing. It's just that if I see a single tier or a three tier, I start asking questions. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not. So the other things about that, how do you get in this situation? More often than not, the single tier becomes about because the conversation started with, I just need a certificate to do X. I just need an SSL cert. I just need a cert for SCOM. I just need a cert for Link. It starts with this really small certificate need. Inevitably, the CA sticks around for a long time and starts doing other stuff that wasn't designed to do. There's nothing in Microsoft Certificate Services that will prevent you from doing something you shouldn't. If you want to stand up a single tier and start doing smart card authentication in your environment, software will do that. It's not going to keep you from doing it. But the odds are, if you don't sit down from the very beginning and figure out what are my certificate needs for the next 8 months, 12 months, year and a half is usually pretty good, you're going to wind up with something that's not going to fill those needs. Fortunately, a lot of customers, I don't want to say a lot because that's not true, a subset of the customers I work with are actually willing to have that conversation in the beginning. And the PKIs that we deployed 12 years ago, and I'm still working with them, it's still the same one. Now, it's been upgraded from the operating system standpoint, but it's the same architecture. The keys have been renewed, but it's the same deployment. The ones that said, I just need something for Link today, I just need something for SCOM today, a couple years later, we're back again, and we're redesigning, we're redeploying, and we're replacing. And sometimes that's unavoidable. But it sucks when it's 6 months later. It's 12 months later. You've spent time, you've spent consultants' time, you've spent Microsoft time, you've spent your own time deploying something. You don't want to throw that away 6 months later. So a little forward sight down the road. More often than not, what that's going to necessitate is something a little stronger, a little more secure, and a little more complex than what you're going to do initially. But at least have those conversations up front. This is one of those things that is not easy for you to go back and fix tomorrow. But have the conversation. Make sure that the infrastructure you're using is meeting your security needs, at least for what you're doing today. So offline root. How many people have an offline root? Okay. Now, I have this in quotes for a reason. I can't tell you how many customers I've gone to that say, we have an offline root. I go, okay, great. Let's do an audit. They power it up and they go, okay, yeah, we can terminal into that. If you can ever connect to a root CA on a network, that's not offline. That's turned off when you're not using it. Offline means not on the network ever. Customers that use physical machines, put some gum in there, you know, stick a screwdriver, something in that network port so it doesn't get on the network. Offline means it's not on there. It's installed offline, it's patched offline, things are transferred offline. You're not able to get that thing on the network. The reason that we have CA keys that are good for a long period of time, one, yes, cryptographically they're useful that long, but two is it's physically isolated from the network. This offline-ness doesn't count. It's too much ambiguity of what was on your network at the time, what could have gotten to it, how many people knew that maintenance was going on. Those are questions you don't want coming to a CA. I'll tell you, in the 10 years I was at Microsoft doing assessments of PKI, the only time I ever got a virus from a customer was a root CA at a bank. Yeah. Because they would do this. They would bring it up on the network. Guess what? Well, it's offline. No antivirus protection. I don't need it. It's offline. I only bring it up once in a while. It got affected at some point when it was on the network. And it infected me, and that made my day not so much fun. So when it's truly offline, what are we doing? One, we're physically isolating it from the network. We're making sure that there's no remote attacks that are available. We really want that to be isolated and away from all potential compromises in the environment. So here is an easy one for you. If you have an offline root and you sometimes let it on the network, don't. How about that for an easy fix? It doesn't get any easier than that, other than breaking old habits. Same thing with virtual machines. If you've got Hyper-V or any of those other products, make sure that that machine doesn't get on the network. Disable the NIC adapter, physically break it, whatever it takes for however your root CA is set up, don't let it on the network. What that means is you have to learn how to use a virtual floppy disk or whatever VM does, or a flash drive if it's a physical machine. So number 10, we've all been waiting for. So number 10, collusion. So one of the things that we want to make sure is because we don't trust anyone. And many times customers will say, well, we trust IT. Well, I trust IT. I trust you all in this room. I don't know you all, but I trust you all. You all look like honest kind of people. But for me, my worst nightmare is a former IT guy. So you all have jobs today. No one's lost their job today, right? Anyone lose their job today? Okay, good. We're all doing good. So you're all trustworthy today. But tomorrow, I don't trust you if you've lost your job. Because that means I don't know what you've gotten your hands on. If we set up a collusion requirement, what we're doing is anytime that something's happening with our CA, we're making sure that two people are present. So that means no one person can go over to their CA, back up a copy of that key, and go, I'm going to keep this at home just in case I get outsourced, in case I get fired, in case I retire and I want to play a prank. So two people are present. Now, a caveat about that, or a couple of caveats. One, that has to exist from the moment that key was created until it's no longer needed. I tell my customers, don't trust me. I don't count as one of those two. You want two people who will always be around with those keys, and the handoff can occur. You want something that's auditable, simple log to say these two people were present when these keys were used. The other thing, calling someone from the accounting department to come watch you do something on the server does not count as a second person. They're going to sit there playing Candy Crush or whatever on their phone, and they're going, oh, great, yeah, you're copying files, great. They don't have enough experience with what should be going on to provide any level of assurance or protection of that information. They might as well not be there. So if you've got any type of security plan in place where you are calling other people that don't know what you should be doing, they're not providing any value. Now, if you've got two technical people there and you have an auditor and the auditor's job is to make sure those are the right two people, that's okay. But that auditor can't be the one that says, oh, yeah, that's the right thing you're doing. So as I said, a moment alone can never be undone. The moment that that key was ever allowed to be touched by one person, that ambiguity is going to hang over you forever, whether you're using an HSM or not. Because if you're setting up an HSM, that person has access to a security world. They've got access to those keys. Who knows what's going on? So from the moment that CA is created until it's no longer in use, two people. So how can you do some of those controls? Some simple things, depending on how complex you want to get. The rack that has the server has a key on it. Everyone gets racks. They usually have keys on it. The person who has that key can't get into the data center. The person who gets in the data center doesn't have the key. So now you have to have two people present. So you can architect controls to do these things. Make sure that there are controls and not just policies, because policies, humans hate policies. We find whatever the easiest way is to do something, and we circumvent policies. So if you've got a control in place, that's how you can enforce those things. So we've got a couple minutes left. So before you all run off for drinks, if you do have any questions, we have a microphone. Was that a question or just a good stretch? Go ahead. Sure, so SHA expiration, very good. So Microsoft makes a good distinction a lot of times when it comes to how things externally are going to be handled versus internally. And a good example of that is the Microsoft root update. These are the things that allow Windows products out of the box to trust VeriSign, to trust GeoTrust, to protect GoDaddy. Microsoft vets these commercial providers, has a set of rules in place so that all Windows operating systems supports those things. So it's already put in place where 1024 is no longer supported. SHA-1 is also heading in that direction now. But what's nice is with the SHA-1 deprecation is the fact that you've got controls to say, oh, I do want this to apply internally to my CAs, or I only want this to be external. So the SHA-1 is coming from the external location. If you've got internal certificates, maybe not even a Microsoft CA, but OpenSSL or other places, you can actually turn on an auditing mode to see what would be filtered out. Or if you've got a security process or standard, you don't want to allow SHA-1 anymore, you can implement that. Now, one of the biggest challenges, a lot of customers are going 2008 R2 and up, we don't talk much about this, is the new crypto, ECC, and SHA-2. A lot of compatibility related issues. So before you start going out saying we're not going to allow SHA-1, you need to understand what applications still need SHA-1 internally before you go turning it off. Other questions? Yes.
Well, theoretically, should the offline root CA be a physical machine?
Sure. So the question is, theoretically, should a root CA be a physical machine? Offline root. And really, this goes back to anything, whether it's a physical machine, or excuse me, whether it's a root CA or a subordinate CA, there's pros and cons. When I was at Microsoft, there was one particular engineer, very well respected, and I love her for this. She was willing to argue the counter side of everything I could ever argue in favor of a physical machine. I like physical machines, and simply because I can put a physical machine into a rack, I can put a camera on it, I can put card keys on it, I can put locks on it, I know where it's at, I know who's touching it. Very easy for me to know where that is, who's got access, I can put man traps around it, very easy to do. Could you mitigate that with a virtual machine? Sure. Some of the downsides to physical boxes is they take up room, take up resources, also means things like hardware failures. If you're using a laptop, laptops go missing, there's no fault tolerance. Virtual machines have some nice things about them. They're independent of the hardware, they don't take up physical space. But now, how do I audit who's touching it? How do I know who's actually logged into that machine or gone into a data center to touch it? More often than not, what a lot of customers will say, I want to do it virtual, but what they really mean is, I want to use my existing Hyper-V machine running a bunch of other virtual machines, kind of put my root on there. So anything that is a risk can be remediated. Sometimes that remediation is simply, we're aware of the risk and we accept it. Are there things that you can put in place to protect that VM? Sure. I would not do any of my CAs in a virtual machine without some type of hardware protection, a hardware security module, because now I'm not only worried about my backups containing my CA keys, but now I've got a ready-to-go hacker-in-a-box kit of a VHD that just gets picked up and copied off, and it's got my keys. So can I put controls in there? Yes and no. More often than not, the offline systems are still physical boxes, and that's where I start in my head. The online boxes, I can accomplish that with virtual machines or physical machines. But if a customer was insistent on doing virtuals, it's a matter of discussing those risks and figuring out what you're concerned about and how do we remediate that. So if you're looking for someone to come argue in favor of physical boxes, I'm your guy. Other questions?
What's coming next?
Drinks in about 5 minutes. You mean the certificate services? I don't know. No. Here's the great thing about having left Microsoft. I can say what I want now, using when I'm not at a Microsoft conference, but it also means certain things are cut off. So I don't know vNext. I don't know what those next things are. So I don't anticipate any major changes, but I could be way off. I can tell you where a concept is going that I'm doing is I'm now starting to think about how can I take these previous models I had of physical machines and virtual machines and do that in the cloud in a protected manner. So I'm actually speaking at Tech Mentor, which is a U.S. conference by Windows IT Pro, later this month talking about hybrid PKI solutions of actually taking these old concepts and how we put them in the PKI in a cloud and still protect the keys. Yes? I'm sorry? Manage multiple CAs. Well, I would rephrase the question and say, what's the best way to manage a CA? Because the challenge is the same. The one place where certificate services has always had a challenge is kind of the management reporting. Some of the things historically with Forefront Identity Manager and the old CLM stuff does a reasonable good job when it comes to smart card certificates and kind of life cycle stuff. There are some new integrated reporting and event logging that you can do with certificate services. But I have to tell you, I actually saw an impressive demo, was it last week? A company called Certified Security Solutions. They've got a product called CMS, Certificate Management Server. It was interesting. I talked to them several years ago. They used to have a product that you could put in all your HTTPS URLs inside your environment and would go iterate all the certificates and tell you the health and when things expire. But they now have a whole management product called CMS4 they just released that does reporting across all the CAs, tells you the health, tells you all the stats. You can see what templates are out there. So I'm just starting to look at that product. CSS, I don't remember their website, but Certified Security Solutions, and their product is called CMS, and they just released version 4. So that's where I would start. Other questions? Yes. What was the last part? Because clients what?
Clients are not hard failing. Like, if I cannot verify the CRL, like browsers and so on, they're just ignoring.
Oh, sure. So the question was, no, is the revocation list and OCSP rendered mootless because clients don't hard fail? I'll put it back. It's up to the application provider and the operating system. So there's this concept of a soft fail and a hard fail. So Internet Explorer is a good example of a soft fail. Even though the RFC says you have to go get the revocation list, if it's not there, consider the certificate invalid. No, Microsoft wants to make sure that the internet browser works for mom. If it goes to a website and validates that certificate, attempts to retrieve the revocation information, but it's not available, it doesn't say anything. So really the revocation importance only comes if we can get to a revocation list and I see it's revoked, then you get a warning. So a soft fail. A hard fail is, wait a minute, I couldn't reach it, or it's expired, or it doesn't exist, or it was revoked, display something to the user. From an application standpoint, that's up to the application provider. Windows provides those APIs to do revocation checking. It returns an error code. The application goes, what am I going to do about it? That is the biggest unknown for a lot of environments of how will your particular application respond when a certificate's not available. The OCSP what? The stapling. So OCSP stapling, the concept of a client goes to, and let me just advance for the people that are going out, and I'll answer that. So a couple things, if you want to stay connected, my website, there's the ADSC hotfix. I'm also on Twitter. If you want to connect, I'll be at the Tech Expo reception now. But there's also the happy hour on Thursday, and then Ask the Experts. I'll be at table 20 if you want to talk security, BYOD, the white paper, anything like that. And for what you're all waiting for, if you want to do a survey here. Here we go. Okay. So OCSP stapling. So when a client goes to a website, the website's going to return the SSL certificate. Well, the number one thing a client's going to do as soon as it gets the certificate is try to figure out, do I trust where this comes from? And also, is it something that's been revoked? So with stapling, we can actually send that information ahead of time to say, I know you're going to come and you're going to ask about my revocation information. It's an efficient transport mechanism that reduces the number of calls back and forth. There are pros and cons for it. From a strictly security perspective, I'd rather rely on a client to go do all the fetching and do all the revocation than allow a web server to preload me with that information. But I can certainly understand it for high volume environments. Now, if you're in Amazon and you don't want multiple queries coming back and forth, it's a much more efficient protocol. But like anything in security, if it's easy or efficient or fast, it's probably not secure. Yes?
Our secure virtual smart card, we have heard it yesterday and we did it before yesterday, if I heard it back. So how secure is that?
So smart card authentications?
Yeah, virtual smart card.
Oh, virtual smart cards. So, you know, I have some experience with virtual smart cards. You could do it out of the box with Windows now. Microsoft is actually a big user of virtual smart cards, and when I was there, I used virtual smart cards. I can say, one, it was certainly a lot nicer than walking around with a bricked laptop because I forgot my smart card at home. And being on the field, if I forget my smart card, I couldn't log on the machine. Now, one of the downsides to the virtual smart card is while the key is stored in a TPM chip, all the authentication that leads up to it is usually the weak point. If you can sign in with a username and password, your TPM chip is going to become accessible, which means you're just as weak without the virtual smart card. If, however, you can put controls in place that ensure that the authentication leading up to the virtual smart card is secure, then you're okay. So you can use the virtual smart card to sign into Windows. So if you say you must sign into Windows with a virtual smart card, great, because now you have to have two factors. You have to have that machine, you have to have the PIN, so you're kind of, it's a little fudgy, it's 1.5 factors, because you know, you've got the machine sitting in front of you. But one of the things Microsoft does is, okay, if you're gonna do that, you have to have BitLocker, and you have to have some type of PIN. I like that because it adds some additional levels of controls in place. So just deploying virtual smart cards and a TPM, yes, you can do it, but the weak link is usually the access to the TPM. But otherwise, they work great. Other questions? All right. So everyone, thank you for coming. Please do your reviews. If you want to talk some more, I'll be at the Tech Expo. Thanks.